Churchill's Secret War, The British Empire and the Ravaging of India During World War II. Written by Madhushree Mukherjee.
Prologue. Our title to India. No great portion of the world population was so effectively protected from the horrors and perils of the World War as were the peoples of Hindustan. Winston Churchill wrote in his 1950 history of the 20th century's most lethal conflict. They were carried through the struggle on the shoulders of our small island. By Hindustan, or land of the Hindus, Churchill meant India, which during the war was part of the British Empire. Britain's wartime Prime Minister did not discuss in his six-volume account the 1943 famine in the eastern Indian province of Bengal, which killed 1.5 million people by the official estimate and 3 million by most others. One primary cause of the famine was the extent to which Churchill and his advisers chose to use the resources of India to wage war against Germany and Japan, causing scarcity and inflation within the colony. In 1947, 2 years after the war ended, India attained independence, in part because the deprivation and anarchy of that fractious era had torn the fabric of its society and were erupting in violence that the United Kingdom could no longer subdue. Yet Churchill's efforts to retain the colony by means of divide and rule also contributed to its partition and to the eventual establishment of the mutually antagonistic nations India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. If the famine garnered little attention not just from Churchill but from 20th century historians, it also occasioned scant surprise, because Bengal had long been synonymous with hunger. Its modern incarnations, Bangladesh and the state of West Bengal in India, rank among the poorest regions of the world. Henry Kissinger, the former US Secretary of State, once described Bangladesh as a basket case. For 2.5 centuries, the history of Bengal, which is in miniature the history of India itself, has featured relentless poverty. But before 1757, when General Robert Clive founded the British Empire by conquering Bengal, it was one of the richest parts of the world, the paradise of the earth, as Clive himself described it. Just as British sovereignty over India ended with a famine in Bengal, it began with one. The famine of 1770 set the stage not only for the British Raj, as the imperial era in India would eventually be called, and the chain of famines that occurred throughout that reign, but also, ultimately, for the emergence of impoverished and strife-torn South Asia. In late 1665, travelling eastward from the Mughal court in Delhi, physician François Beignet arrived in Bengal to find a vast, populous delta, its myriad channels lined with vibrant towns and cities interspersed with fields of rice, sugar, corn, vegetables, mustard, and sesame. He declared it the finest and most fruitful country in the world. Foreign merchants worked the wholesale markets, offering to buy produce in exchange for silver. They could not trade goods with the native businessmen because Bengal was in need of virtually nothing. Its rice travelled to Sri Lanka, called Ceylon by the British, and the Maldives, its sugar to Arabia and Mesopotamia, and its silks to Europe. Ships at its ports were loaded with such exports as wheat biscuits and salted meats, opium, varnish, wax, musk, spices, preserved fruits, and clarified butter. Bengal's cottons, which supplied much of the world, were astonishing in variety and quality. 20 yards of a delicate muslin could be stuffed into a snuff box. One can only imagine for what sublime piece of fabric another 17th-century visitor, Mirza Nathan, paid 4,000 rupees, given that a single rupee bought a score of chickens. Bengali merchants, whose ships plied south to Sri Lanka and west to Gujarat, ate from gold plates and wore intricately wrought brocade clothing and gem-studded gold jewellery. nor were the lowly in want of shelter or food. The three or four sorts of vegetables which, together with rice and butter, form the chief food of the common people, are purchased for the merest trifle, Bernier attested. Fish and meat were so plentiful, he added, that the region's many Portuguese immigrants virtually lived on pork. Bengal abounds with every necessary of life, he wrote, concluding with a wink. The rich exuberance of the country, together with the beauty and amiable disposition of the native women, has given rise to a proverb in common use among the Portuguese, English, and Dutch, that the kingdom of Bengal has 100 gates open for entrance, but not one for departure. At the time, Bengal was a part of the larger Mughal Empire, whose emperor in distant Delhi ruled weakly through his representative known as the Diwan. The rulers could not always provide physical security. Portuguese pirates raided the coastal villages and carried off tens of thousands of slaves, and marauders from central India routinely descended on horseback to lay waste to the western districts. But because the revenues from Bengal were vital to Mughal power, the Diwan attended to the province's long-term prosperity. In the early 1700s, a far-sighted Diwan named Murshid Kali Khan reformed the administration. 16 powerful zamindars, or overseers, and about 1,000 minor ones ran the province under his watchful eye. The zamindars, who called themselves Rajas if they were Hindu and Nawabs if they were Muslim, maintained armies, collected taxes, and ran the courts, police, postal services, and often the schools. Villagers owned the lands they tended, and not even bankruptcy could evict them. Tax-exempt fields attached to temples and mosques aided the poor, whereas those who excavated ponds or made other improvements earned tax remissions. Agricultural taxes, a fifth of the harvest, could be paid in kind without resort to moneylenders. The state, recognizing farmers, spinners, weavers, and merchants as the source of its wealth, tried to protect them. The money in the hands of the people of the country is my wealth, which I have consigned to their purses, explained Alivadi, a ruler in the mid-18th century, cautioning his grandson, Siraj ud Daula, to abstain from extortion. Let them grow rich, and the state will grow rich also. Soon, however, Bengal would descend into subjugation and ruin. Upon descending to the Bengal throne, the impetuous Siraj ud Daula confronted the British East India Company. In 1717, the company had obtained from the Mughal emperor in Delhi the right to trade salt, opium, tobacco, and betel nut, a mild intoxicant, without paying customs duties. But many of its employees were claiming this right for their personal transactions and thereby defrauding the royal treasury. Moreover, in 1756, war broke out between England and France. The company, fearing attack by French merchants, began to fortify its riverside trading post, Calcutta, and ignored the new Diwan's order to desist. Siraj ud Daula pursued a rival into Calcutta and took English prisoners, many of whom died of suffocation in an airless room that would become notorious as the Black Hole of Calcutta. This episode, embellished by Europeans and propagated as proof of native savagery, would retroactively help to justify what came next, the conquest of Bengal and, ultimately, India. General Robert Clive came to the rescue of Calcutta and defeated Siraj ud Daula at the Battle of Plassey on June 23, 1757. Clive's victory was aided by his conspiracy with Siraj ud Daula's general Mir Jafar, who became the new Nawab. As arranged, Mir Jafar paid the East India Company £2.2 million and its officers and troops £1.2 million, of which Clive took a lion's share. 200 barges, carrying the first instalment of the company's booty, set off from the capital city of Murshidabad on July 3, 1757, accompanied down the Ganga or Ganges River by the trumpeting of a British military band. It was a momentous occasion, for countless such tributes would thereafter flow from east to west. That day, another procession in Murshidabad displayed Siraj-ud-Daula's body draped over the back of an elephant. Bengal now had a government beholden to the company, but its treasury was empty. Mir Jaffa's unpaid soldiers mutinied. The British East India Company's senior local officers, known as the Calcutta Council, soon replaced him with one of his rich relatives, Mir Kasim, claiming as a reward for his elevation to power another £200,000 for themselves and, for the company, the revenues of the prosperous districts of Midnapore, Burdwan, and Chittagong. The council put the task of collecting taxes up for auction, ceding it to whoever promised the greatest returns for each of the contract's 3 years. Thus numberless harpies were let loose to plunder, whom the spoil of a miserable people enabled to complete their first year's payment, related Harry Verelst, a later British governor of Bengal. The new ruler, Mir Kasim, was not a weakling. Since the triumph at Plassey, every Englishman had been trading without paying customs duties, which not only pinched the treasury but undercut local businessmen as well. Bengal's towns began to empty out, bankrupt local merchants moved to other Indian cities, and shopkeepers took to downing their shutters and running when British traders and their soldiers approached. Some winders of silk cut off their thumbs for fear of being forced to work in factories run by Englishmen. Mir Kasim protested, complaining also that these British merchants force the people to sell their goods at a quarter the price and tyrannize over the common man and the trader. In the noblest moment of his unhappy reign, he rescinded customs duties for everyone, native and foreign alike. Affronted British merchants now demanded that the duties be restored for all but themselves. Mir Kasim conceded, provided the East India Company remove all its troops from Bengal's soil. The result was war. Mir Kasim, soon defeated by the British, fled westward, ultimately dying in obscure poverty, and Mir Jafar returned to the throne, paying his British protectors another £500,000 for the privilege. After his death in 1765, the Calcutta Council installed one of his sons, in return for a payment of £230,000. Also during this year, Clive rendered a final and momentous service to the British East India Company. He gave its emerging empire a legal foundation and a lucrative source of income by obtaining from the ever-weakening Mughal Emperor in Delhi the right for the company to collect the revenues of Bengal province. This vast administrative unit, larger than France, comprised 3 segments, Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa, regions that were differentiated by language. In return, the emperor would annually receive £272,000, which left, in Clive's estimation, a clear gain to the company of £1,650,900 a year. As a result, the East India Company became de facto ruler of India's richest province. Within 5 years, Bengal became India's poorest province. The stream of treasure flowing to England had led to a boom in the company's shares, a boom that was threatened now that Bengal had run out of money and its industries lay in ruins. The directors in London had come to expect enormous profits, even as they owed His Majesty's government an annual payment of £400,000. So the company proceeded to collect agricultural taxes with unprecedented rigour. It parcelled out by auction the task of extracting revenue from the entire province. No longer were taxes a portion of the harvest to be paid in kind. The company operated on the principle that all land belonged to the state and fixed the tax at a specific monetary level, now called rent. This had to be paid in silver even when a crop failed, and farmers who could not pay lost possession of their land. The company did make more money. For instance, the annual revenue from Bihar, which previously hovered around £200,000, shot up to £680,000. The tax collectors were so oppressive, wrote cloth merchant William Bolts, that farmers were often necessitated to sell their children in order to pay their rents, or otherwise obliged to fly the country. For centuries, gold and silver had poured into Bengal. They now poured out. The East India Company no longer had to transport bullion to India to purchase goods for selling abroad. Instead, the tax revenues from Bengal supplied all the capital it had previously imported for investing in trade, and more. If a district yielded, as in the case of Birbhum, £90,000 of revenue, the council took care that not more than £5,000 or £6,000 were spent in governing it, explained a 19th-century historian, William Hunter. From the remainder, £10,000 or so were deducted for general civil expenses, £10,000 more for the maintenance of the army, and the surplus of, say, £60,000 was invested in silks, muslins, cotton cloths, and other articles to be sold by the authorities in Leadenhall Street. The revenue enabled the British East India Company to build on that London thoroughfare an expansive administrative centre called the India House. Often, the company's officials diverted the tax surplus to finance wars in Madras and to purchase tea in China. Silver also flowed out when Englishmen sent their profits home. Between 1766 and 1768, Bengal imported £624,375 worth of goods and cash and exported £6,311,250, the amount going out 10 times greater than what came in. Such an economic drain could not go on forever. By 1769, Bengal had no gold, silver, or other valuables left. A group of Armenian merchants, whose trade in the region long preceded that of the British, petitioned the Calcutta Council, complaining that the lack of currency had brought virtually all business to a halt, so that not only a general bankruptcy is to be feared, but a real famine in the midst of wealth and plenty. Then the rains failed. "The fields of rice are become like fields of dried straw," wrote a superintendent. Recognizing that the cost of rice would go up, British officers and their Indian agents, who enjoyed a monopoly on trading rice, bought up all that they could, often forcing peasants to part with the grain they had kept for planting. The British East India Company dispatched a shipload of grain for its forces in Madras, stocked up 5,000 tons for local troops, and, fearing that revenues would fall short, urged rigour in tax collection. By then the famine was in full force. "All through the stifling summer of 1770 the people went on dying," Hunter recounted. "The husbandmen sold their cattle, they sold their implements of agriculture, they devoured their seed grain, they sold their sons and daughters, till at length no buyer of children could be found. They ate the leaves of trees and the grass of the field, and in June 1770 the resident at Murshidabad affirmed that the living were feeding on the dead. A third of the people of Bengal, numbering about 10 million, perished." The British East India Company's policies had clearly aggravated the disaster. Despite repeated petitions, the company had refused to march a brigade of troops out of a hard-hit district of Bihar, where they were appropriating all the available grain, to a region farther west that was better provisioned. Calcutta's officials feared that if the troops were not close at hand, the French would take the chance to invade from bases in the Indian Ocean. The company also prohibited trade in rice among the districts of Bengal, unless the grain was destined for the cities of Murshidabad and Calcutta, the administrative centres of Bengal and the company, respectively. In particular, the southern and eastern districts were permitted to export rice only to Calcutta. A contemporary observer would note that as much grain was exported from the lower parts of Bengal as would have fed the number who perished for a whole year. Most important, during previous droughts, agriculturists would have possessed grain stored in anticipation of a bad year, as well as jewellery, coins, or other savings they could use to purchase rice. Neighbouring areas had a decent harvest. One zamindar bought rice in Banaras, west of Birhar, had it transported down the Ganga in barges, and distributed it to famine sufferers on the riverbanks. By 1770, however, rural Bengal had no currency left, even as, at the height of the famine, speculators were selling their hoards of rice at 6 times the usual price. Virtually every employee of the company reaped huge profits in rice speculation. One company clerk in Murshidabad, who could ordinarily scrape together no more than £200 a year in savings, allegedly sent £60,000 to England that year. The East India Company did spend £9,000 on famine relief, mainly by buying rice in the districts and distributing it in the cities of Murshidabad and Calcutta, even as it collected from Bengal that fiscal year a substantial rent of £1.4 million. Bihar, where many villagers lost 4/5 of their population, yielded the company a little above £400,000 for 1770, an amount that led the London directors to complain of being deeply affected to see ourselves disappointed. Amazingly, at the end of that year, a tremendous crop stood in the fields, planted by hands no longer alive to reap it. In February 1771, the Calcutta Council reported to the directors, "Notwithstanding the great severity of the late famine and the great reduction of people thereby, some increase has been made in the settlements, revenue collections, both of the Bengal and the Bihar provinces for the present year." The revenue did not fall, commented a subsequent Governor-General, Warren Hastings, owing to its being violently kept up to its former standard. Large harvests appeared the next 2 years as well, and the company's annual earnings continued to rise as its agents forced villagers to pay the rent owed by dead neighbours. While the country every year became a more total waste, the English government constantly demanded an increased land tax, Hunter wrote, adding that the collections inevitably faltered. The villagers of Birbhum were dragooned into paying the land tax by Mussulman troops, but notwithstanding the utmost severities, the receipts seldom amounted to much more than 1/2 of the demand. The level of taxes that the company had grown to expect could not be met because there were now far fewer plantings of rice to tax. With no hands to tend them, a third of Bengal's fields returned to jungle. Most of the province was a fertile delta, formed over millennia by the Ganga and its distributaries. In the absence of cultivators, its natural state was tropical forest. The impenetrable growth invaded formerly prosperous villages and shadowed tiny hamlets where the few inhabitants lived in terror of the jungle's rampaging elephants and man-eating panthers. In 1780, 2 battalions of sepoys, native soldiers in the employ of the British, trying to force their way through Birbhum, a district considered at one time to be the highway of armies, found all the way a perfect wilderness, infested with tigers and bears. Communications broke down throughout Bengal because the postmen began to get carried off by wild animals. Many of the surviving villagers deserted their lands and, led by Hindu sadhus or Muslim fakirs, men of religion, took to waylaying British consignments for grain or cash and looting any fields of rice they could find. The rebellion was the first of innumerable peasant and tribal uprisings that would harass the British Raj for the rest of its reign. Bengal's capital city of Murshidabad, where the dead had lain in piles on the street, fed on by dogs, jackals, and vultures, never recovered from the famine and its after-effects. By 1771, Calcutta, which historian Narendra K. Sinha states was well supplied with grain at a time when many places from which it was brought were destitute, stood alone in all of Bengal as an island of wealth. Desperate people trekked to Calcutta in search of food. I have counted from my bedchamber window in the morning, when I got up, 40 dead bodies lying within 20 yards of the wall, besides many hundred lying in the agonies of death for want, bending double, with their stomachs quite close contracted to their backbones, wrote a correspondent who signed himself J.C. in The Gentleman's Magazine, and who did not care to have the dying so proximate. I have sent my servants to desire those who had strength to remove further off. Until the famine broke out, few people in the United Kingdom comprehended the source of the East India Company's profits. Numerous fleets of large ships, loaded with the most valuable commodities of the East, annually arriving in England in a constant and increasing succession, had given rise to a misconception, a parliamentary committee subsequently observed. This export from India seemed to imply also a reciprocal supply, by which the trading capital employed in those productions was continually strengthened and enlarged. But the payment of a tribute, and not a beneficial commerce, to that country wore this specious and delusive character. The depopulation that resulted from famine eventually led to a steep drop in the company's revenues, burst the speculative bubble in its shares, forced it to seek a loan from the Bank of England, and laid its affairs open to scrutiny. Clive, deemed by some to be the richest man in the United Kingdom, had become a member of the House of Commons, but was obliged to answer to Parliament for corruption. He was charged with having received in India valuable gifts that were deemed to belong rightfully to the company. Although he was cleared of blame, for unknown reasons, Clive took his own life in 1774. The British Parliament gave the East India Company a loan of £1.4 million and appointed Warren Hastings, a gifted protégé of Clive, as the first Governor-General of India. Hastings instituted an English-style legal system in Bengal, basing certain of its aspects on what he understood to be local custom. He also sought to repair the company's fortunes by cancelling the portion of Bengal's revenues that were to go to the Emperor in Delhi, and by subjugating Oudh, a prosperous kingdom west of Bengal, and subjecting it to rigorous tax collection. As a result, Oudh became forlorn and desolate, and in 1784 underwent famine. Hastings returned to England a rich man, but he too had to answer for his foreign adventures. In an impeachment trial that dragged on for 9 years, statesman Edmund Burke accused Governor-General Hastings of venality and brutality. The company's revenue collectors, Burke charged in some of the most sensational testimony of the time, had stripped naked the wives of tax defaulters, dragged them from their homes, put the nipples of the women into the sharp edges of split bamboos, and tore them from their bodies. Although Burke's outrage was genuine, historian Nicholas Dirks argues that his crusade had a deeper motive. Burke hoped to cleanse the emerging empire of corruption and cruelty, and to ensure that its benefits flowed not just to employees, shareholders, and directors of the company, but more broadly to the people of the United Kingdom. He succeeded in his greater objectives. In the end, Hastings was acquitted, but according to Dirks, empire emerged from the trial stronger than ever. In 1793, after a period of anarchy and intermittent famine that lasted 2 decades, Governor-General Charles Cornwallis reformed the land revenue system in Bengal. He had earlier commanded the British forces that were forced to capitulate to George Washington's army in Yorktown, Virginia, in 1781. Cornwallis returned to the zamindars their hereditary role of collecting taxes, and fixed the annual revenue owed to the state at £2.68 million, in the hope that such a permanent settlement would inspire them to tend their fiefdoms. Using the steady income from Bengal that Cornwallis's reforms assured it, the East India Company went on to conquer or otherwise annex kingdoms in central, southern, and western India. Compliant princes were permitted to continue ruling their kingdoms as long as they paid a retainer for protection by the company's troops. Bitter campaigns in the northwest ended with the fall of the Sikhs in 1849, bringing the border of the Raj to the edge of Afghanistan. In most of the newly conquered territories, the company gathered its own land tax, which again it called rent, a levy of up to a third of the potential crop, which was often more than the harvest actually produced, ultimately became the norm for rent across much of India. As a result of the relentless benchmark of rent, in contrast to the Mughal tax, which varied with the harvest, land rapidly passed out of the hands of farmers and into the possession of moneylenders. An elderly peasant explained to a revenue official the essential insecurity of the system. "They told me that the river was passable at such and such a ford," he said, "and on their word I tried to cross it, but fell into a deep hole and was nearly drowned. They told me, when I struggled back to shore, that the average depth was quite safe, but that would not have kept me from drowning." To pay their rent after a poor harvest, farmers had to mortgage their future crops and eventually their plots, ultimately losing everything to usurers and ending up as labourers working for low wages in what had been their own fields. In the past, a peasant's land was secure even if he could not pay taxes. But British law in India invariably upheld the rights of creditors, who became critical cogs in the machinery of revenue extraction. A variety of economic traumas, ranging from the ravages of war and exactions of rent to natural calamity, led to a series of famines all over India. The Madras region, for instance, suffered famine in 1783, 1792, 1807, 1813, 1823, 1834, and 1854. Unlike the Bengal famine of 1770, the 19th century calamities excited little comment in England, where influential scholars such as James Mill argued that poverty rather than wealth was India's intrinsic and unvarying condition. Hindu legal codes contained guidelines for helping ordinary people through seasons of calamity, and Mill pointed to the existence of such regulations as evidence that a state of poverty and wretchedness, as far as the great body of the people are concerned, must have prevailed in India in the past, just as in the present. Mill asserted that the British conquest of India was ordained by the inexorable progress of humankind. Ascendant societies had many enemies. As a result, he wrote, one of the first applications of knowledge is to improve the military art. Superiority in the battlefield was a sign of cultural advancement. Muslims, such as the Mughal emperors, had ruled India for centuries, which indicated to Mill that their civilization was superior to that of Hindus, and the reins had naturally passed from them to Christians. The distinction between Hindus and Muslims, originally one of uncountable fissures in multifarious India, had sharpened with colonial attempts to classify the subcontinent's populace. Having encountered Muslims for centuries, the British believed that they knew them, a valiant, warlike, monotheistic people who, despite being occasionally savage, deserved respect. Indian Muslims were, in truth, far more varied and sophisticated than such a caricature would allow. Sufi saints, for instance, preached love rather than war. But once Muslims had been pegged, Hindus came to be defined by their perceived differences with their Islamic compatriots. Hindu was originally an ancient Arab or Persian appellation for anyone living east and south of the Indus River. It signified residence rather than religion. The myriad beliefs of Hindus, ranging from the extreme non-violence of some to the human sacrifices by others, could scarcely be classified as a single faith. Nevertheless, Mill and others believed Hindus to be endowed with distinct characteristics, at the core of which lay effeminacy and its corollary, dishonesty. Unable to face what Mill called the manliness and courage of our ancestors, The defeated Hindus, with their slavish and dastardly spirit, were wont to employ deceit and perfidy in achieving their ends. Over time, educated Indians came to internalize such distinctions between Hindus and Muslims, although the illiterate continued to worship at one another's shrines. A succession of 19th-century authors developed the argument that British rule conferred the benefits of a superior civilization to a people who had hitherto floundered in superstition and strife and was justified thereby. In 1885, Tory politician Lord Randolph Churchill elaborated on the theme. "Our rule in India is, as it were, a sheet of oil spread out over a surface of, and, keeping calm and quiet and unruffled by storms, an immense and profound ocean of humanity," he declared. "Underneath that rule lie hidden all the memories of fallen dynasties, all the traditions of vanquished races, all the pride of insulted creeds. And it is our task, our most difficult business, to give peace, individual security, and general prosperity to the 250 millions of people who are affected by those powerful forces, to bind them and to weld them by the influence of our knowledge, our law, and our higher civilization, in process of time, into one great united people, and to offer to all the nations of the West the advantages of tranquility and progress in the East. That is our task for India. That is our raison d'être in India. That is our title to India." Beneath the sheet of oil, the colony bubbled and foamed. Between 1760 and 1850, the company's troops had to be diverted to suppress more than 40 serious rebellions in different regions. In 1857, the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Plassey, central and northern India erupted in unison, with thousands of villagers joining sepoys of the Indian Army and disaffected princes in violent opposition to British rule. A medley of social and economic grievances had combined to produce the Sepoy Mutiny, as the British called it, or the Rebellion of 1857, as historians know it today. Many of the sepoys were one-time farmers who resented the deprivations that had forced them to enlist as mercenaries, the racial discrimination that kept them from ever becoming officers, and the threats to religious purity entailed by certain army practices. Villagers hated the new revenue system, and royals feared the loss of their kingdoms. The most memorable of the rebel commanders was the Rani of Jhansi, who ruled a small principality in central India, and who led into battle not only her own forces, but also those of two Nawabs. Her death by gunfire, when she was about 20, marked the end of the uprising. It was a bloody affair indeed. The rebels killed several hundred white men, women, and children. The 50,000 British soldiers imported to put down the uprising avenged these murders 1,000 times over. Such, at least, was the claim of General Hugh Rose, who sacked the city of Jhansi. After suppressing the rebellion, the United Kingdom dissolved the East India Company and formally assumed the reins of government. On November 1, 1858, Queen Victoria proclaimed that henceforth the British Empire would be ruled for the benefit of all its subjects. In practice, control over India would rest with the British public, acting through their Parliament and a Secretary of State for India based at the India Office in London. The Governor-General in Calcutta acquired the title of Viceroy, underlining his status as the Queen's representative. Loyal native princes retained their kingdoms but remained subservient to the Viceroy. A mutiny charge of £50 million, the cost of importing British soldiers to put down the uprising, was deducted from the colony's account. Military strategists decreed that sufficient numbers of white troops should always be stationed in India to forestall further mutinies, and British officers painstakingly rebuilt the native portion of the Indian Army with martial races, mainly tall and light-skinned farmers from the northwest. They were Sikh, Muslim or Rajput, the last group being Hindus who were believed to have retained fighting qualities possessed by their ancestors. Furthermore, because sepoys of diverse regions and religions had united in attacking their superiors, the generals segregated such groups and trained the regiments so that Sikh might fire into Hindu, Gurkha into either, without any scruple in case of need. Gurkhas are a mountain-dwelling people from Nepal. By the end of the 19th century, the Indian Army was a formidable force called up in British battles from Africa and Afghanistan in the west to Burma and China in the east. Even as they brought the recalcitrant sepoy under control, the British rulers of India came to perceive an even more potent threat, the educated Hindu male, or Babu. Many of the Babus were conversant with Western thought and were asking to be treated according to Enlightenment principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity. A few had entered the Indian civil service by travelling to London to take the requisite examinations, and their presence in the system emphasised the conflict inherent in the British Raj. Equality under the law was held by the conquerors to be one of the great benefits bestowed upon Indians, but native judges were not permitted to preside over cases involving whites. In 1883, Lord Ripon, one of the rare liberals who attained the office of viceroy, resolved to remove this discrepancy, only to provoke a furious outcry. For, as historian Thomas Metcalfe points out, it was no easy matter at once to treat Indians and Europeans equally and then to claim the right to rule a conquered India. All said and done, it was faith in racial superiority, the belief that natives were incapable of the supervisory tasks that whites performed, that supplied the theoretical foundation of the British Raj. Englishmen and women, many of them based in Calcutta, penned furious attacks on the Babu, often spelling it Babu to suggest a link with the primate. Mill had declared that the Hindu, like the eunuch, excels in the qualities of a slave, and the popular historian Thomas Babington Macaulay had dwelt on the emasculation of Bengalis who'd found the little finger of the company thicker than the loins of the prince, Siraj ud Dawla. Several authors now embellished these images. The writer Rudyard Kipling repeatedly portrayed the Bengali civil servant as a nincompoop who, in a crisis, fled the scene and left the real men to pick up the pieces. It was the Bengali male's extraordinary effeminacy, as evinced by his diminutive physique, his flowing clothes, and his worship of goddesses, that best illustrated why he, and by extension India, had to be guided by the firm, benevolent hand of a supremely masculine race. Even as the Babus realized with a shock how contemptible they were to the British, a popular novel suggested how they might prove their manliness. In 1882, a Bengali civil servant named Bankim Chandra Chattopadhyay had dramatized in the novel Anandamath, the insurrection that followed the famine of 1770. In a conscious response to Macaulay's jibes, the writer imagined the rebels as warrior saints who readily shed blood in defence of their motherland. The novel was a covert call to arms that offered visions of heroic self-sacrifice to angry youths and inaugurated an era of Bengali militancy. A rather more sedate group of Indians, mainly lawyers and civil servants, came together in Bombay in 1885 to form the Indian National Congress. They hoped to articulate native grievances and seek redress from within the British imperial system, and over the next two decades they won greater representation for Indians on legislative councils. These had negligible power, but would form the basis of the more substantive legislatures of the future. In 1905, when Viceroy George Nathaniel Curzon announced a plan to sever the large and unwieldy province of Bengal into two parts, the Congress initiated a mass public protest. The province was to be divided into a predominantly Hindu western fragment and a largely Muslim eastern one. Bengal united is power. Bengal divided will pull several different ways. One of our main objects is to split up and thereby weaken a solid body of opponents to our rule, explained a British civil servant. Curzon, who regarded Muslims as potential allies against the largely Hindu nationalists, visited the city of Dhaka in eastern Bengal to inform the region's Muslim zamindars how partition would enhance their influence. In 1906, the All India Muslim League came into being in Dhaka and declared its support for the Viceroy's partition plan. The Congress, which opposed partition, introduced a powerful weapon of Irish invention, a boycott of British goods. Thousands of students forswore foreign fabrics. Bonfires flared on Calcutta's streets, consuming jackets, trousers, and other Western clothes. In the first year of the agitation alone, the importation of cotton goods fell by a quarter. Dadabhai Naraji, a mathematician and businessman who headed the Congress, declared the greater goal of the movement to be Swaraj, or self-rule. In 1911, a new viceroy succumbed to the persistent economic pressure and revoked the partition. The large province of Bengal was instead broken up along linguistic lines, with Bihar and Orissa becoming separate states. India itself would no longer be administered from Calcutta, but from New Delhi, far beyond Bengal. It would be a very good idea to move the government offices away from the Bengali Babus, who now swarm in every office, noted a visitor to the city. No Englishman has a good word for them. They are said to have less character and backbone than any other Indians, and to be intolerably conceited, besides being seditious. In 1912, when the Viceroy ceremonially entered the newly built capital city on a caparisoned elephant, some revolutionaries lobbed a bomb that seriously injured him. The chief conspirator, who escaped to Japan, turned out to be a Bengali Babu. Bengal is the seat of bitterest political unrest, the producer of India's main crop of anarchists, bomb throwers and assassins, observed American writer Catherine Mayo in Mother India, a 1927 travelogue that described Hindu males as pedophiles enervated by excessive sex. Bengal is also among the most sexually exaggerated regions of India, and medical and police authorities in any country observe the link between that quality and queer criminal minds, the exhaustion of normal avenues of excitement creating a thirst and a search in the abnormal for gratification. This book, the outcome of a tour organized by British intelligence, would so captivate Winston Churchill that he would pass it around among friends. On August 4, 1914, the British Empire went to war against Germany. India presented £100 million to the United Kingdom as a contribution for war expenses and sent troops to the Middle East and Europe. More than 60,000 of its soldiers would die fighting World War I. In rural India, wartime inflation, the export of grain to the war theatres, and drought made it difficult for the poor to afford enough food. Epidemic forestalled famine. The Spanish flu, which soldiers brought home from the icy trenches of Europe, thrived on emaciated frames and killed an estimated 12 million. Mainstream Indian nationalists cooperated with the British war effort and expected political concessions as a reward. So when the government of India hailed the end of World War I by enacting a repressive law, Indian rage boiled over. Among other provisions, the Rowlatt Act of 1919 allowed the government to imprison indefinitely and sentence by tribunal, not trial, anyone suspected of sedition. A visionary leader, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, stepped to the fore and called for civil disobedience against what he termed a devilish law. Gandhi was 49 and had returned to India a few years earlier, after a 22-year sojourn in southern Africa. Born in Gujarat in western India in 1869, he had trained as a lawyer in England and moved to Natal, a British colony, to set up a practice. There, Gandhi had come to identify with impoverished Indian labourers who worked on plantations and mines and had championed their rights. In the process, he had forged a political and moral weapon that he called Satyagraha, transliterated as Passion for Truth. Someone who offered Satyagraha by, for instance, refusing to obey an unjust law, had to follow a path as sharp as the sword's edge, Gandhi wrote. He or she had to abjure violence and bear no animosity toward the opponent, no matter how intense the hardship. Satyagraha postulates the conquest of the adversary by suffering in one's own person. Gandhi was sensitive to the charge that Indians were cowards. He recalled in his autobiography a ditty in his native Gujarati, which he and his schoolmates used to chant. "Behold the mighty Englishman, he rules the Indian small, because, being a meat-eater, he is 5 cubits tall." As a child, growing up in a strictly vegetarian family, he had secretly sampled meat because a friend had assured him it would make him brave enough to fight the English. Yet the adult Gandhi repudiated what he regarded as the Western definition of courage, a willingness to take life. In his view, true courage lay in upholding one's own values, and especially in enduring all manner of torment without being provoked into violence. But India was not ready for Satyagraha. During the civil disobedience movement, crowds took to rioting and many died in police firing, so Gandhi called it off. He had yet to learn about the massacre in Amritsar, a city hallowed by Sikhs. On April 13, 1919, General Reginald Dyer had placed troops at the entrance of an enclosed park where men, women and children had assembled, some to celebrate their new year and others to listen to a speech. Gatherings of more than 5 were forbidden. Dyer had issued a warning and ordered the troops to open fire. The death toll was 379 by the official count and more than 1,000 by the Indian reckoning. It was an extraordinary event, a monstrous event, an event which stands in singular and sinister isolation, Winston Churchill declaimed at the House of Commons when it discussed the affair a year later. The elder son of Lord Randolph, Churchill was then the 45-year-old Secretary of State for War in the British Cabinet. He privately agreed with military officers on the necessity to shoot hard, but he was also aware of the importance of Sikhs to the Indian Army. "One needed to remember that the colony was not ruled by force alone," he continued in his speech, "and that a sense of unity and cooperation must ever ally and bind together the British and Indian peoples." It was too late for such sentiments. Muslims, who were also vital to the Indian Army, had been angered by the breaking of a British promise to maintain the control of the Ottoman Emperor over holy cities such as Mecca. After the war, the victors proceeded to divide up that empire, with the United Kingdom acquiring portions of the Middle East, not so much for the oil as to secure the region around the Suez Canal. Leopold Amory, a Tory politician and a leading strategist, asserted that it was necessary to develop a contiguous British empire that would run from Cape Town through Cairo, Baghdad and Calcutta to Sydney and Wellington. After the Amritsar tragedy, when Gandhi was finally allowed to enter the Punjab, a vast and emotional crowd greeted him at the railway station. The entire populace had turned out of doors in eager expectation, as if to meet a dear relation after a long separation, and was delirious with joy, he remembered. The official inquiry into the atrocity, he concluded after conducting his own investigations, was a whitewash. Until then, Gandhi had believed that the British Raj, though liable to make mistakes, was fundamentally benign and just. Renouncing that faith, he cast about for ways in which to achieve Swaraj. On August 1, 1920, the Indian National Congress, acting in concert with prominent Muslims, called for civil disobedience and received a staggeringly positive response to their summons. Every corner of India erupted, each with its own cause. Peasants organized against landlords, laborers in tea plantations struck work, indigenous peoples defied the law to hunt and gather in forests, students walked out of schools and colleges, and prominent lawyers quit lucrative practices. A Bengali Babu named Subhas Chandra Bose, who had just passed the Indian civil service examinations in London with high marks, abandoned his prospectively prestigious career and joined the Congress. A Muslim leader called upon Muslims to quit the Indian army and was promptly arrested. Even the revolutionaries shelved their arms for a year to give Gandhi's methods a chance. They were all to be bitterly disappointed. In a small town in northern India, policemen fired on a procession, whereupon the irate mob chased them into the police station and set it afire, burning 23 people to death. The incident horrified Gandhi, who persuaded the Congress to call off the movement in February 1922. Despite its abortive end, the protest revealed that, for the first time, overwhelming numbers of Indians were united under a single banner and inspired by Gandhi, who came to be called Mahatma, or Great Soul. Gandhi's moral stature and popularity, even among some English men and women, made him the most baffling adversary that the British Empire had ever encountered. I often wish you took to violence like the English strikers, and then we would know at once how to deal with you, a South African official had said to him, only half in jest. But you will not injure even the enemy. That is what reduces us to sheer helplessness. Gandhi was a contradiction in terms, fragility turned into strength, a dangerous feminine man. To Winston Churchill, who was profoundly committed to the British Raj as well as to the knightly values of valour, honour and chivalry, Gandhi came to represent Hindu guile, a malignant subversive fanatic, and a thoroughly evil force. When World War II broke out in September 1939, the people of the United Kingdom turned to Winston Churchill for leadership because he personified the British lion, indomitable in adversity. "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty," Churchill declaimed, "and so bear ourselves that if the British Commonwealth and Empire lasts for 1,000 years, men will still say, 'This was their finest hour.'" The Prime Minister's fierce determination buoyed Britons and helped them to rise above the tribulations to come. One caught Churchill's infectious spirit that this was a great time to be alive in, that destiny had conferred a wonderful benefit upon us, and that these were thrilling days to live through, remembered historian Robert Rhodes James. Churchill's utterances also indicated his dedication to the British Raj. He hoped, at least, to see the British Empire preserved for a few more generations in its strength and splendour, as he had written to the Viceroy of India. But in March 1942, 3 months after escalating the war with the attack on Pearl Harbor, Japanese forces smashed the Empire's defences and occupied Burma. They thereby cut off a vital source of rice imports for the Indian poor and simultaneously established themselves at the colony's mountainous eastern border. Fearing that India itself would be invaded, British authorities acted on a scorched earth order issued by the War Cabinet, the group of ministers and officials who made all the key decisions of the war. They removed provisions such as rice and transport facilities such as barges from coastal Bengal, where the enemy was expected to arrive by sea, creating another of several conditions that would culminate in famine. At the same time, India's people were reluctant to fight a war that held little promise of freedom for them. In August 1942, the Indian National Congress called for civil disobedience to protest the colony's forced participation in World War II. Gandhi and other nationalist leaders were swiftly arrested, unleashing what the Viceroy would describe as the most serious rebellion since 1857. The authorities arrested more than 90,000 and killed up to 10,000 political protesters. India was an occupied and hostile country, a British general declared. At the same time, the Indian Army continued to fight in theatres around the Mediterranean Sea, and Indian fields and factories supplied them and other troops with food grains, uniforms, boots, parachutes, tents, ammunition, and innumerable other necessities. Virtually all of India's industries had by now been redirected towards supplying the war effort, and the government was printing paper money to enable its purchases. The price of grain spiralled ever upward. A cyclone damaged Bengal's rice harvest. The local administration stocked up on rice to feed soldiers and war workers, and famine broke out in early 1943. According to an agreement drawn up 3 years earlier, a portion of India's war expenditure would ultimately be reimbursed by His Majesty's government. The amount owed to India, called the Sterling Debt, swelled during the course of the war until it came to reverse the traditional economic relationship between coloniser and colony. For the past century, India had owed money to the United Kingdom because of the mutiny charge, the investment for building railways, the pensions owed to British civil servants, and other loans and expenses. Now, for the first time ever, the United Kingdom owed money to India. The sterling debt worsened Britain's post-war economic prospects and became a source of immense frustration to the Prime Minister and his closest adviser, Lord Chirwell. Chirwell, a scientist of German aristocratic lineage who was so deeply racist that the presence of any black person evoked physical revulsion which he was unable to control, aided Churchill with logistical matters such as the distribution of shipping and allocation of food supplies. Ominously, his recommendations almost always prevailed. Also in 1943, the nationalist Subhas Chandra Bose came to head a liberation army based in the Far East. The so-called Indian National Army comprised expatriate Indian labourers and captured soldiers of the British Indian Army and was allied with Japan. It threatened India's eastern border with attack, while insurgents on Bengal's coast prepared to welcome Bose and his forces should they arrive. With the empire at risk from a military invasion and discord rife even as Bengal's people began to starve, Churchill was called upon to make a choice that would tilt the balance between life and death for millions, whether or not to expend valuable wheat and shipping space on providing famine relief to Bengalis. Chapter 1. Empire at War. In my view, England is now beginning a new period of struggle and fighting for its life, Winston Churchill wrote in 1933. And the crux of it will be not only the retention of India, but a much stronger assertion of commercial rights. As the world began to edge toward war, none of the globe's other empires, such as the French or the Dutch, were about to relinquish their possessions, and Japan was already conquering new realms. According to Churchill, who was urging armament against a newly resurgent Germany, this crucial moment was no time to cede political powers to Indians, as the British government was planning to do. In the conflict to come, he believed the United Kingdom would need its huge and resource-rich possession as never before. 6 years after Churchill's avowal and 2 days after the Nazis began their blitzkrieg into Poland